We're here with the legendary James Wilkinson, one of the most brilliant musicians that I know and have ever had the pleasure to work with. But James, I can't thank you enough for being here and taking the time to do this and for your great music. And so cool to see you again. It's been like, what, more than 12 years since we saw each other.
I think approximately 2002.
Is that? Yeah, because I sort of...
15 years anyway.
Yes.
Yeah, but I think... time is so elastic that I can't really tell anymore.
Exactly. I always tell people we're just living in a subset of eternity.
Yeah.
But, I really wanted to compliment you on your bass playing and your guitar and your singing, but this is a broadcast of On the Brink Radio. I'm not sure exactly what number it'll be, but... So tell us just a little bit about your background as a musician. Have you been a musician ever since you were really young?
Yeah, I took up guitar at the age of 9, so that's 40 years ago, at the behest of my father, who was determined that all his sons would pick up an instrument because he'd sort of missed out himself. So I was the youngest. I ended up on guitar. The middle one ended up on piano, and the oldest one ended up on drums.
Did you ever play with them?
Yes, yes.
Really?
Yeah, when we got a bit older, into our teens, yeah.
That's cool.
I got an electric guitar, middle brother on bass and big brother on drums, and we billed ourselves as the Wilkinson Swords.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, so did you start on electric guitar or a Spanish guitar?
I started on acoustic guitar and moved to classical guitar for a couple of years at high school.
Okay.
For technique.
Did you play in the band or orchestra or anything in school or anything?
No, nothing like that. But after a couple of years of classical, I gave it away because I was badly wanting to play some rock and roll. So bought myself an electric on the proceeds.
What kind of guitar was it?
Oh, it was a...
Strat?
No, but it was Music Man Sabre, which is a offshoot of Fender anyway. They're good guitars. I wish I still had it.
Really? That is so awesome. So when did you take up the electric bass? Or did you play acoustic bass before that?
No. The electric bass sort of... It's kind of accidental because my brother played bass and he played fretless. And I was kind of going, oh, that's kind of cool. So I got myself a bass eventually and went, right, I'm pulling the frets out. And that was about 30 years ago.
Wow.
And, I haven't really looked back on that one. I like the expressive quality of the fretless.
Yeah, so you're fretless bass playing, and you use this little electromagnetic thing called an e-bow. I've never heard anyone do that before, and it's a very, very, very unique sound.
It's unusual to hear it used on bass, but you'll hear it used quite often on electric guitar by the likes of Steve Howe of Yes or Robert Fripp of King Crimson.
Yes, well, I'd like to ask you about what both of those people might be doing these days, but not quite yet. Let's keep on with you. So would you consider that you're equally a guitar player and bass player, or do you consider one or the other more of your forte or favorite instrument?
I guess the guitar would probably be more the forte, but I enjoy both instruments equally, but I've been playing guitar longer.
Yes.
So I guess there's a more degree of mastery, if you will, on the acoustic guitar than the fretless bass. I'm no Jaco Pastorius, you know, but I can make that.
Well,
I can make it sing in its own little way, you know.
Very truly, and technically, are we correct in saying that the bass actually is a guitar? A bass guitar, is that what they call it?
Well, that's a bone of contention for many bass players.
Yes.
Who regard a guitar as something that has six strings.
Yes.
And that's how it is.
Yes.
So if you're playing a Fender 6, which is a six-string guitar, bass guitar, then you could feasibly call it a bass guitar. But four strings, for some purist bass players, it's a bass.
Yes.
It's not a guitar.
It's sort of like in Australia. A lot of people who aren't from Australia think of koalas. They call them koala bears.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're not really bears. They're kind of bear-like, but so is a wombat and a Tasmanian devil. But
yeah,
they're not actually bears, so they're, you know, they're koalas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're their own unique little species.
Absolutely. Well, we first met... I think you had Hamster had already disbanded this sort of I don't know, would you call it a jazz quartet, or you don't really like that word?
No, I love the word jazz, but in terms of what Hamster did, jazz was just one reference point to the music, which we all shared, but we couldn't come up with anything. We came up with to describe it was usually some over-hyphenated nightmare kind of string of words, you know, like avant jazz, funk, fusion, quirk, or whatever, you know, and it just made no sense. It was just music, but it definitely had a jazz backbone.
Yes. And but by the time I met you, and you, we met because you, I'd already met you and heard you play a few times, but asked you if you'd be interested in putting some of your electric bass onto a recording that we had done in Christchurch in 2002 that came to be called First Ancestor, which started out because the reason I'm remembering just as I'm talking, because at the time we did the recording, I didn't know you yet. And I had invited another bass player to come on the original session at the studio in Oxford. That I forget the guy's name, but he has a really nice 9-foot Steinway grand piano. Duke Dixon.
Oh, yeah.
Duke Dixon studio. And Ian McAllister came and engineered and stuff like that. And it was me on grand piano, Carmel Courtney, who you played with in Hamster on saxes and vocals, and the also legendary Redford Grinnell, who at that time was the drummer for Shapeshifter, kind of an electronic drum and bass outfit. But then he played his friend's jazz drum kit, and he's a really brilliant drummer.
Mm.
And but so that was just a jam. We fired up a couple of doobies and just played for an hour or so, and we, you know, and working on the mix down with that at Ian's studio, and then that's when you came in and laid down a bunch of really, really cool bass. Just sort of, I mean, I think you had listened to what we had done a bit, but you didn't want to listen to it too much. I remembered you saying that you wanted to be kind of like you were just there jamming along.
Yeah, well, I wanted to try and, on some level, recreate the spirit of the recording.
I really wish you could have been there with us live.
Yeah, because it was quite a tricky thing to come in afterwards, but as I recall, there was still plenty to latch on to musically there.
Ah, yes. I think that's a really cool recording.
Mm.
You know, it's not physically impossible that all of us couldn't get together and jam again someday.
Yeah, that's right. It's highly possible.
Well, so now tell me about what you've been doing musically in the interim since 2002.
Yeah.
You were also doing gigs where you were singing and doing originals and possibly covers?
Yeah, some covers, not many. But the solo thing has always been adjacent to everything else I do, but still very much part of my musical life. But on the whole, most of my work tends to be collaborative these days. Since 2002, I've done quite a lot of touring with a wonderful Northumbrian piper, Mr. Jimmy Young, who was in a band with Karua for 25 years.
Is that R-U-A?
Yeah, that's right. Jimmy has left us now. He succumbed to bone cancer, sadly, a couple of years ago. But he and I had a duo. We kind of called it sort of Celtic, kind of, what would you call it? It's like heavy Celtic, you know. Wall of sound Celtic with his pipes and big heavy guitar and
instrumental
songs as well.
Okay.
Yeah, some quite intense in your face renditions of Celtic tunes as played on the Northumbrian pipes by Jimmy.
And would it have did you and him both sing on this?
No, I was the singer, but he played whistles and Irish drums as well, you know, the baron.
Yes, so you have some recordings of that?
Yeah, not with me here, but yes, they exist. And there's, I think, plenty of stuff floating about on YouTube. Other than that, it's been primarily recording collaborations, touring collaborations. Just a real mixture. At the moment, I'm working with two female singer-songwriters in Nelson, helping them with just colouring in their music.
Yes, and so you're performing live with them, but then also doing stuff in the studio.
Yeah, that's right. So just finished a album project with Mr. Bob Bickerton in Nelson, which is sounding very lush. So as long as I'm busy, you know, I'm happy.
Well, it seems to me that you're very busy.
I can be. Yeah, it's been better since I moved to Nelson from Christchurch because the earthquakes changed the musical landscape so much.
And the physical landscape too.
And the twain meet, you know, because like all the venues I used to work in, they were all destroyed.
Huh. Well, you know, it's very interesting. I also got in touch with a person. I talked to him on the phone a couple of days ago. Did you know a guy named David Guthrie?
I have the name.
His their dad used to be the mayor of Christchurch. They owned the Guthrie Center.
Oh yeah.
And it was him who originally bought some of my painted rocks for his shop, but then he put me on to his brother about the possibility of doing that big mural that I was doing at the time whenever I was, you know, when I met all you guys and was hanging around Christchurch. And said, well, I just talked to him on the phone a couple of days ago, and he's doing really well, but his brother Peter is now heading up the organization that's fundraising for the project to rebuild the cathedral.
Oh, right.
I thought that was really cool.
Interesting circle.
Yes.
Yeah, oh, that's fascinating.
What if, I wonder how much attention, did you ever, for any reason, play music inside the cathedral before it was came down? Did you? Did it have
good
acoustics?
Amazing. Rua, the band that Jimmy led as a piper, we played there twice, once in 1991, then 10 years after, in 2001, and we've got albums off both of those. One's called Live in the Cathedral, and the other one's called 10 Years After.
Well, that is so cool, because I was just wondering what kind of acoustics it had.
Extraordinary.
I think I went in there once, but I certainly wasn't in a position to make any sounds or play any music or anything. But, you know, I think cathedrals in general tend to have nice acoustics. But how cool would it be? I wonder if the people that are sort of, I mean, I don't know about this, but I'm guessing that they'll probably reconstruct it pretty much to the T.
I suspect so.
If they're going
to
do it.
Well, it's taken them 6 years to arrive at any kind of decision, and it's it's been very frustrating for the people of Christchurch because, I mean, A, the city is named after this building, and B, it is the centre of the city, and it's just been a vast pigeon hutch for 6 years.
Yes.
And it's just quite demoralising. So it's even doesn't matter if you're not a religious person. It's a beautiful building. I've got a great connection with it, having played in it. Three times, in fact, and the acoustics were glorious.
Well, it'll be really interesting, and maybe your recordings that you did in there, they can be the litmus test to compare the acoustics as soon as the new one is finished.
Yeah.
That would be very interesting.
It was the most glorious analog reverb you could imagine, you know. It really was.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
I'm dreaming now. But what if they had a really nice grand piano in there and I was able to go in there and play with Ian McAllister recording?
That'd be nice.
Yes. Do you ever go in the studio like by yourself and just kind of go crazy and record stuff and just kind of make up?
No. No, I do all my invention just privately. I don't record it. I record it in my brain.
Yes.
And just through repetition it becomes something. But I do have a little handheld, you know, one of those Zoom devices, you know, the little handheld digital recorder.
Oh, Zoom, they're actually quite good.
They are very good, but I'm a bit of a technical dunce, so I'm not very good with it. But I do have one, yeah.
Well, my attitude towards all the technical stuff is like, I want to know enough that I can make it do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
But I don't want to have to be worried about if it's not working right. I'd rather that it just work and then you don't really have to think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's move on to some, I'd like to, on this show, I'd like to, you know, have a good part of the show be your actual music and stuff like that, and maybe you can help me choose a few selections that we can put together.
Yep,
and stuff. We were talking when we did this really cool musical journey Sunday a week ago here at Grant Knowles' place with you and me. And Kate Liddell, Grant Knowles, and Nicola on flute and keyboards, and we just sort of, I'd call it a jam, but it was a sort of a more guided sort of musical improvisational journey, and it turned out really cool.
Yeah.
But we were talking before that, and I was telling you about my interest in work and my films about the whales and dolphins and how much I work with whale sounds, and you said you actually have a two record set of songs of whales.
Yes, I do. It's in a garage in Christchurch at the moment, but it's there. Yeah.
But you say you'd pull it out and listen to it at times.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I haven't for years, but it's there. I do have a number of albums that feature sort of environmental recordings.
Yes.
A whole series of work by Paul Horn, who was famous for playing saxophones and flutes in sacred spaces.
Did I tell you that he became my friend on Facebook a couple of weeks ago?
Right, nice.
So he must be still doing music. No. You said Paul Horn.
Oh, you mean Paul Winter?
Paul Winter, that's who I meant.
Yeah, well, I was getting to him.
Okay.
Yeah, he's awesome too.
Wow, well, interesting.
You know, duets with Timberwolves and things like that.
Yes, I saw the debut performance of an album of theirs. This would have been around 1980. called Misa Gaia,
mm-hmm.
and it was live in some cathedral in San Francisco, and it had really cool acoustics in there.
Yeah.
But Paul Horn, yeah, now I think of him as a flute player, but he plays saxophones too, but he does the recordings like in the Taj Mahal,
right.
and the Great Pyramid,
right. yeah.
and he tells stories of how he had to pay off all these people to leave him alone in the Taj Mahal, and he had to wait, and like once he was in the middle of a recording and somebody opened a door,
yeah.
and it just echoed, it just ruined the whole recording.
Yeah.
But you know what, it was very interesting, if we are able to talk more about sort of the technical side of like music and what exactly music is from both metaphysical and a physics perspective and stuff like that, but there's been a lot of talk in recent years about this, about changing. I mean, I want to ask you what kind of sense it actually makes, the whole thing of changing from a tuning system that's based on A440 to like 432.
Mm.
And to me it sounds like if you just drop everything by 8 cycles a second, then that's the same thing, you know, and what difference that would make and stuff. But anyway, what I was going to say is on Paul Horn's recording inside the Great Pyramid, the very first sound you here is him striking the king's coffer with his fist,
mm-hmm.
and he said it resonates at a pure A440. And so I was just going to go, if that's really true, what does that tell you about the Egyptians? Because that pyramid would date back, we don't know how far, but at least quite a few thousand years.
That's right.
You know, before European civilization and all that stuff.
Mm. That's right. I don't know. I mean,
why would they choose that note?
That's a mystery. It's a glorious mystery, really.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that the center of the piano scale, or is that middle C?
I think it's middle C. A bit out of my depth, to be honest, with this sort of thing. But
having a background in science and stuff, I've always been really interested in this kind of stuff. But mm-hmm. the further I go, the more I'm sort of moving away from all that.
Right.
And I'm going like, you know, I'm not really sure that that mathematics and frequencies and numbers and stuff actually exist in nature.
Mm.
You know, it's more of a, it's like a kind of a cartography of our mind that we're projecting onto things. But tell us, what is music to you? And I know that I have to paraphrase Steve Martin, the comedian. He said, talking about music is like dancing about architecture.
Yeah.
So it doesn't...
That's a beautiful, beautiful quote. I'm aware of that quote. And it's... He nails it to a point, because there is an unknowable nature to music, but like all artistic creation, it's it's universal. It's a language that everyone understands, even if it's just a few regional dialects of it. It truly is a universal phenomenon, I feel. You know, they talk about the harmony of the spheres. Well, you know, I believe it resonates on a fully trans-dimensional level.
Very interesting, because, you know, like the music of the spheres, was that coined by Kepler?
Yes. Yes.
Looking at the harmony of the planetary motions and stuff, but I think the part that he didn't figure into the musical equation was the catastrophic impact, the catastrophic dimensions of heliocosmic phenomena. You know, when you've got the nice literally planets going around for thousands of years, but then a giant comet comes crashing through. You know, and so like it'd be interesting to do, you know, the music of the spheres version of the Comitus Interruptus.
Yes, well, it's sort of like a kind of unscripted kind of brass moment, isn't it?
Yes. Well, look, so now tell us about who are some of your favorite artists that have been maybe influential on you through your life, and if you listen to people's music now. I know we could talk for hours just on this.
We could, but I can keep it fairly brief. The first exposure to anything that captivated me deeply was the Brandenburg Concertos, James Bach.
Yes. Performed on harpsichord?
Yes, harpsichord, but there's also Baroque trumpet features in a couple of them, and I was entranced by the sound of that very high, beautiful, deft trumpet playing, you know, because I only understood it to be a sort of jazz instrument. Well, that came later, but that was the first album I thrashed as a small child. I just, my parents had one of those suitcase phonograms, you know,
mm-hmm.
the ones that fold up,
mm-hmm.
you open it up, and the speakers are there in the lid. James Bach got a big thrashing. Later on, my aunt was a great influence on me in terms of introducing me to fairly modern jazz a la Charles Mingus, Miles Davis, but also kind of more left field geniuses like Frank Zappa, the music of Jethro Tull, which still resonates for me strongly today. Because for me, Jethro Tull, they incorporate everything I love about music, and they touch on every style that works for me.
They're very diverse.
Very diverse.
And what about their lyrics? Where did all that come from?
Jethro Tull?
Yeah. Did Ian Anderson write them?
Yeah, he wrote pretty much all of them, yes. And he draws on everything, you know, everything. Just like Frank Zappa, fearless, you know. Yeah, absolutely fearless. But, yeah, no, like I said, we could go on for hours about this, but always had a soft spot for what we now call prog rock.
Yes.
But it was never called prog rock at the time.
No. Well, what about, I think some of your guitar work has reminded me of a guy named Michael Hedges.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, taken from us too soon.
Absolutely. I think his car went off a cliff on the California coast in fog.
That's right.
Something like that.
Somewhere in the vicinity of Mendocino, I think. Yeah, that was tragic. Deeply tragic, because it was only 40-something.
He was just getting going.
It was just getting going, and for me and for many guitarists, when they first heard the opening bars of Aerial Boundaries, which came out on Windham Hill in 1984, it fundamentally changed the way we viewed the acoustic guitar as a means of expression.
Because he was playing it like a keyboard, kind of,
like a keyboard,
he?
But his percussive approach to it, his harmonic approach to it, was just groundbreaking.
What tuning was that song in?
I believe that it was in CC, so double C, DGAD.
By double C, because it was a 12 string?
No, it was a 6.
Oh, was it? Okay.
But he's got a, it's not a unison C, it's an octave pair.
On two adjacent strings?
On two adjacent strings. I believe that's the tuning, but I may be wrong.
Wow, I've never thought that you could go from one octave to another on two adjacent strings.
Oh, you can. My guitar is generally tuned DAD, GAD, DADGAD, which is a standard kind of Celtic folk type tuning. But I frequently use tunings that are like AA, DGAD, so you've got that lovely, rich, long, big bass notes, or a double G.
And each one's an octave apart.
Yeah, octave apart. You can tune unisons as well, which can sound really funky.
Would it be possible to tune? You couldn't have all six strings on the same note, could you?
Not exactly the same note. You'd have to string the guitar especially for that, but you can do crazy unison tunings, but they'll be, you know, over a spread of maybe two or three octaves.
Yes. This is really interesting. I play a little guitar. I hesitate to use the word. I use the word play when I talk about my own musical ability, because I'm certainly not nearly at the technical level that you're at on anything. But I love to play, and I play with the instrument.
Yeah.
You know, people like what I do, and I'm really interested in doing stuff with other people and with layering and multi-tracking with myself and doing sort of like experimental sound collages and stuff like that. But exploring alternative tunings is just like, that's a whole world in itself.
Which Michael Hedges, again, opened that world up for me fully, because I was starting to experiment, but once I heard the sounds he could create and learnt what some of his tunings were, because you'd never be able to discern what they are through his playing.
Really?
You'll get a glimpse of... You can sort of understand where it's coming from, but individual strings, very hard to tell sometimes.
Did he never say what they were?
No, he published all his tunings at some point. They're all freely available on the net. And some of them are outlandish, really outlandish, and that's how he gets his textures and his tones.
Did he ever do, when he played, he did play 12-string some, right?
No, not really.
Really?
No, no.
I don't know why. I thought some of those sounds, I thought it sounded like a 12-string.
But... Yeah, well, on his very first album, called Breakfast in the Field, there are moments that are very reminiscent of Leo Kottke.
Yes.
Because that's one of his big first influences, but he never actually physically played a 12. What he did do was he moved to harp guitar.
Yes. How was that constructed?
Well, Gibson actually made them in the early 20th century. There were guitar orchestras back then, ranging from the harp guitar right up to little piccolo guitars. They were quite a thing in the 20s. The 20s in America.
Was it held upright?
Yes, it was held like a normal guitar, but large-bodied, but it had a second neck coming off the top of the body, joining onto the headstock, which had usually half a dozen, but sometimes more, free-floating bass strings like a harp.
And you pluck on those?
You could pluck while you're doing your thing there, you can throw in a bass note.
Have you ever played one of these?
I've played one in Wellington that was a fairly, not a very well constructed one, but yeah, they're a lot of fun. Yeah, because it just extends the range of the guitar even further without having to detune.
Well, also, what do you mind sharing what alternative tunings that you're using right now?
Primarily they are.
Oh, you said dadgad.
Yeah, most. I've got a lot of tunings, but a lot of them are very specific to a particular piece or song. But the ones I come back to most are variations on DAD, GAD, dadgad. So there's AAD, GAD, which is the double A. There's GGD, GAD, double G. And one I use quite a lot is CGD, GAD. And there's some very rich textures and tones to be had with these tunings. I won't go into some of the more arcane tunings I use because they're just getting a bit bizarre.
Well, I'm guessing that there's real, I mean, technically there's no reason to stop someone from creating something that's quite dissonant or atonal.
That's right. From a performance point of view, it's not very practical to be going, especially if you've only got a couple of instruments. If you have a whole battery of instruments, you can tune them however you wish and just pick up the instrument for the piece you're about to do. I don't have that. So I tend to float around maybe a handful of tunings, maybe half a dozen generally.
Yes, there was this really brilliant guitar player that I met in Arkansas, and I think I might have given you some of his music because I thought that you might have appreciated it. His name is Richard Johnson.
Yeah.
I sort of fell out of touch with him, but he, when I saw him live, when I first met him, it blew me away because he was playing he had a 6-string Taylor and a 12-string, and he would change the tunings while in between songs,
mm-hmm.
while he was talking.
Yep.
You know, and that seemed like a pretty
it's quite a clever thing,
challenging thing to do.
Yeah, although most of the time nowadays people have inline tuners or even tuners built into the guitar. I don't trust digital tuners. I don't believe that they actually take into account the vagaries or the quirks of the instrument. They just tune each string
individually.
It's mathematically, but then you might tune each string individually and it looks perfect, you know, according to the device, but then you play a chord and it goes, ugh.
Absolutely. Well, isn't that what you're talking about?
You have to tune the tuning.
Well, yeah, exactly. Isn't this what they call is there a tuning called well-tempered?
Yeah.
Well-tempered tuning, but like I think I've read that if you tune a piano totally mathematically, it sounds terrible.
Well, it doesn't sound terrible, it just sounds a bit unusual, because what you get is this perfect third for a start, which to most Western ears sounds like it's just a touch flat. But to my ears, it just sounds magic. Magical.
Well, so now, what you're hinting at something here. For example, I've always wondered, you know, there's really no way for us to know what anything sounds like to somebody else.
No.
Or beyond, you know, outside of our species. You
well,
know,
that's right.
How birds would hear us,
yeah.
Or how whales would hear us, and all this. Or, you know, we don't really know how another person sees color.
Correct.
Yeah, we make guesstimates on it,
yeah.
And stuff like that, but everybody would theoretically maybe be slightly different, right?
Well, for a universal language, you know, basically it's ultimately a very personal tongue, you know. You know, it might be a universal language, but the way we perceive it, the way we express it, is so personal to us, you know. So one person's magic is another person's kind of rubbish, you know.
Yes. Well, is it possible to hear silence?
No, it doesn't exist. John Cage proved that it doesn't exist. His famous silent piano piece called 4:33 is 4:33 of the pianist. Do you know of this phenomenon?
I've heard of it, but does it have things like people opening the door and coughing and stuff like that?
What it does have is the performer, for want of a better word, it's actually basically a piece of theatre rather than a piece of music.
Because they turn the pages of blank music, right?
There's no page turning required.
Okay.
The pianist goes out to the keyboard in the concert hall. He lifts the lid. He then sits in silence for 4:33, closes the lid, and leaves the stage. The composition, for want of a better word, is basically whatever happens in the interim. A nervous cough, you know, someone going...
A siren?
Yeah, anything that's extraneous.
Wow, so has did he record different versions of this?
There will be recordings of it,
really?
Yeah. Yeah, there will be recordings, and what you'll hear is Formats 33 of Near Silence.
Yes.
But well, silence does not exist. I don't believe it exists anywhere.
Well, you were saying before, like, even if we're in a, even if we were in a sensory isolation chamber, you'd still probably hear the internal sounds of your own body.
Correct.
Or, like you were saying, the blood pumping and different kind of noise inherent in your nervous system.
Yeah. And then, the intake of breath.
Yes, exactly. And probably... I'm guessing that if you were in an isolation tank long enough, you would probably, your brain would start calling up memories of sounds. Mm. Now, this is a really interesting thing to ask you as a musician, because I love music and I've listened to a lot of music in my life. And sometimes I'll find myself listening to something in my head, and it's like I can really hear. It's really hard to describe. It's not exactly like I'm hearing it with my ears, but I'm hearing it to a degree of fidelity that's got like all the different parts, and it may not have the ultra low frequency, you know. But I hear a degree of richness of the different, you know, aspects of the music. And is it the same with you?
Yeah, to a degree. But the only time I feel like I can hear the entire spectrum is when I go to the seaside, especially to a stony beach.
Yes.
Incoming tide, outgoing tide. The sound that you hear with the incoming and outcoming, it's like every single frequency is represented from the lowest sub-bass to almost inaudible highest frequencies. The sea seems to contain every frequency known to man.
How,
to my ears.
That is the coolest thing, man. And so would that be what they call white noise?
There is a degree of white noise in there, but there's also other waveforms going on too, which I can't describe because I'm no acoustician.
But white noise then isn't... I mean, I always thought that was supposed to be an equal amount of all the different frequencies. But even that can be interpreted many different ways.
Mm. I mean, we tend to think of that tidal sound of a shh as a white noise, which I presume it is, but sometimes listening to the sea and the intake of breath and the exhalation of is like I hear the lowest sub-frequencies I could possibly hear in there as well. And every beach will be different, of course.
Absolutely. And at different times of day.
But to me, it sounds like every sound that has ever been made is present in the sea, you know?
Wow, that's a... Wow. Wow, that's a cool... Can I quote you on that?
Yeah, by all means.
That is so cool. Well, now check this out. Tell me what you think about this. It's slightly off the topic of music, but it still has to do with this kind of like cyclical variations in natural phenomena. I was reading in an article by this... He's one of my favorite minds of the 20th century, named Emanuel Velikovsky.
Mm-hmm.
He was a psychoanalyst, and he was a very close friend of Einstein. And he studied under Freud. But he was writing an article about the importance of electromagnetism as a force in the universe. Because, you know, we even in the world of today, most of the celestial mechanics is formulated in terms of gravity, which is Newtonian.
Yep.
But in Newton's time, they hadn't even discovered electromagnetism.
Mm.
So he talks about this kind of thing. But anyway, in this article, he observes that barometric pressure is known to exhibit two maxima and two minima regularly spaced a day in the exact same way that tides do.
Right.
Now, isn't that interesting? If that's really true, well, what would...
So you're talking like tidal air?
Yes.
Right.
And I haven't followed up, but I don't think somebody like Velikovsky would be saying that unless he got it from a very credible source.
Oh, it sounds highly feasible to me.
Yes, but I'm just wondering if, you know, so much of the whole physical universe is based on what could really be called music, musical relationships.
Cycles, repetitions, bar lengths, if you would like.
Yes.
Yeah, no, yeah, I agree. Yeah. So it's just one strand of the many that holds the universe together as far as I can see and hear.
Wow. Well, let's talk about prog rock a little bit. Grant told me, I shared this with you before, I knew that Keith Emerson had passed away, the keyboard player from Emerson, Lake and Palmer. You told me the details of what had happened, but you said that Carl Palmer... is going strong.
He's alive and well. He's touring as Carl Palmer's ELP Legacy, So he's on the drums, of course, but he's got a bass player and he's got a guitarist taking all the parts that Emerson would have taken in the ELP music. It doesn't sound quite logical, but I haven't heard their work, but apparently they're doing really wonderful and very faithful, to a degree, renditions of the ELP catalogue.
Yes.
So, but because Emerson and Lake both died last year, yeah, that's the legacy. So they're not my favourite band by any stretch, but they have entertained the hell out of me in the past.
Yes, I listened to a bunch of their early stuff.
Oh man, Tarkus is extraordinary.
Just Take a Pebble.
Beautiful.
And Cast It to the Sea.
That's gorgeous.
Yeah, and Greg Lake's voice. And wasn't he the original singer for King Crimson?
Correct, yep. That's right. And bass player in the first album.
Yes. So now, what do you reckon Robert Fripp's doing now?
He's out there still with a new version of King Crimson, which is basically a double trio.
Explain that. A double trio.
Actually, it's not quite right, but he has toured as a double trio. Two drums, two bass, two guitar.
Really?
Mm. This particular lineup has three drummers.
Really?
Yep.
Any of them names that I might recognize?
Pat Mastelotto.
He's probably working with like younger dudes.
Yeah, he's got a couple of old hands on board. He's got Tony Levin on bass and Chapman Stick.
Yeah.
And he's also got Mel Collins, who used to play sax on the very early King Crimson albums.
Really?
Yeah.
Like the very first one?
Yeah, in the second, third.
Like on 21st Century
Oh, no, that was Ian McDonald. He's on the second album, In the Wake of Poseidon, onwards up to about Lark's Tongues and Aspic, I think. Yeah.
Now, King Crimson, that was some freaky stuff.
Yeah, well, they're still doing their thing. It's a rebooted version, but they are dipping back into the past, which Robert Fripp resolutely refused to do for decades.
Yes.
It all had to be new.
Yes.
21st Century Schizoid Man? No way.
Hey, tell me what song this is from. Cigarettes, ice cream, figurines of the Virgin Mary. It's called The Great Deceiver.
Oh, yeah, that's
from Starless and Bible Black.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but some of this stuff.
John Wetton, he died fairly recently, too.
Did he?
Yeah.
Well, what about all the musicians that passed away in 2016?
Yeah, there were many, and a lot of them weren't household names like David Bowie or whatever, but a lot of prog people went. You know, John Wetton, Keith Emerson, Greg Lake.
And these guys weren't all just in their like mid 60s, weren't they?
Usually late 60s and just pushing 70 or whatever. So
just hit middle age.
Yeah, usually illness got them. In the case of Keith Emerson, he took his own life.
Yes, I was really sad to hear that because he lost the use of his wrists because of
he couldn't play the piano due to some degenerative condition of his hands.
He probably just wore them out.
It's possible. It's possible, but he couldn't see a life without his music, and he chose to take an exit.
I would have been happy to just listen to other people's music for a while.
Yeah, or find a new way to make sound.
Well, I mean, because Miles Davis got a synclavier in his last couple of years.
He's always experimented, but the trumpet was always there. But that's right. They're fearless. These fearless pioneers like Miles Davis, Frank Zappa. You know, true pioneers.
Yeah. What's your favorite stuff that Zappa did? Did you ever hear of his symphonic stuff?
Yep, it's fascinating. It's highly influenced by his heroes, which were...
How do you pronounce it? Varese?
Stravinsky, etc. Yeah, very dramatic music, some of it, and quite quirky, but that's him, you know. It stands up. But it stands up to anything, any other modern composition, as far as I can tell. But Frank was never satisfied.
Well, he was a pretty wicked electric guitar player, too.
Absolutely, but he was never satisfied with orchestral players, you know. They just could never play the notes the way he heard them.
I remember some quote that he said. He was talking about how, like, playing with an orchestra was like working with a dinosaur, but it took like an hour for the nerve impulse to get from his tail to his brain or something like that.
That's about the upshot of it, yeah. Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
No. Also, Steve Howe, the guy from Yes.
Yep. Extraordinary player.
Is he still doing music?
Yeah. Well, we've got this very interesting scenario now where Yes, and this has happened before in the past, they have now splintered into two different versions. So there's the original version, which actually, actually contains not one single original member, because Chris Squire, the bass player and founder, died in the last couple of years as well.
Yes.
John Anderson was sort of they left him behind. And for many, here's the voice of Yes, and Yes without John Anderson is no Yes.
It's just maybe.
But he suffered from a quite a bad respiratory illness.
Did he?
And Chris Squire, such a workaholic that he just chose to keep on going with a new singer. So we actually got a Canadian Yes tribute singer to step in for him. So what's happened now is that you've got an original Yes lineup which has no original members in it, and a new Yes, which is called Yes featuring Rick Wakeman,
really?
John Anderson, and Trevor Rabin, who was in Yes in the 80s.
Yes, he was the owner of A Lonely Heart.
That's right. For a little while, they were calling themselves ARW, Anderson, Rabin, Wakeman. And they went, oh, this is unyielded. This is Yes music.
It sounds like Arl.
Arl. Well, the alternative to that was War or Raw. they wisely went with Arl. But essentially it's a form of Yes. So they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame about 6 months ago.
Yes.
It was a bit tense because you'd have all these past, present members together on the same stage going, oh, you're not the real Yes. However, this new kind of Yes, which has John Anderson in it, he is a founding member. He is the only founding member, extant.
Yes. Well, what about Bill Bruford?
Bill Bruford's not having anything to do with that anymore.
Really?
But he was part of the Hall of Fame thing.
Yes, well, yeah. But he drummed for King Crimson for a while too.
Yep. Yeah, he jumped ship from Yes to join King Crimson around about 1973.
Okay. Now, did you ever hear his solo thing called One of a Kind?
I heard of it. I've seen it around, but never heard it.
When it first came out, this dude said, "It sounds like Classical Weather Report," but it's got this guy named Jeff Berlin playing bass that was trying to kind of be like Jaco Pastorius.
Yeah.
And then he did a second one called "Gradually Going Tornado." But I started listening. And Chris Squire had a solo album called "Fish Out of Water."
Yeah, that's a nice album.
Yeah.
I loved his work. It's because, yes, especially albums like Tales from Topographic Oceans and whatnot, which are quite long-winded, but I think they're beautiful.
It was their Eastern phase.
Yeah, well, some call their music quite wishy-washy at the stage, or a bit airy-fairy, a bit, maybe a bit pretentious.
It was
or whatever.
Vedic.
Yeah, well, that whole album was based on John Anderson's understanding of
the Bhagavad Gita, wasn't it, or something?
Partly,
like
or the Shastric texts or something.
Yes.
I'm a bit out of my depth there. But mystical texts, which inspired him. So this music is very ethereal at times and very expansive, but it's always underpinned by this muscular, beautiful bass playing of Chris Squire, you know. He was no airy-fairy bass player, he was a thumper. He could really, you know, real edge. And that's what stopped Yes from getting too floaty.
Yes.
Yes.
Like that song Roundabout.
Roundabout is extraordinary.
That's a kick-ass song.
That's a beautiful song.
That whole album.
Yeah, Fragile is a fantastic album.
And then In Close to the Edge.
Yep, again, brilliant.
Down by the River.
Yep, Down by the River, yeah.
Well, yeah. So who would you say is your very favorite prog rock band of any decade? Or can you pick one?
Hard call. I mean, probably Jethro Tull, because they do get lumped into that category.
So now tell us about them. Have they had basically the same members all along?
No, apart from the only constant has been Ian Anderson.
What about Barrymore? I mean, who was the guitar player?
Martin Barr.
Martin Barr, yeah.
He was more or less original. He was on the second album. But when Ian Anderson retired, Jethro Tull was an active unit about 10 years ago.
Did he? I thought they were still touring.
He tours. But he's like curating his own work. Yeah. So it's like Ian Anderson plays Jethro Tull, and he's got a new band to do that with, which left Martin Barr out in the cold. There was a bit of a wee bit of angst over that because he felt like he'd just been dumped, you know. But Ian rightly pointed out that it's all his own work, and he can choose to express it however he wishes.
Yes.
But it meant effectively an end of Jethro Tull as a name band, and now he's still touring at the age of 70, but it's Ian Anderson plays Jethro Tull, or Jethro Tull's Ian Anderson.
Isn't it true that Jethro Tull was actually a historical person from like the 1500s? He was like a kind of an agricultural revolutionary or something?
He invented the seed drill.
Did he?
Mm.
really cool. But isn't it funny? A lot of people go like, they think Ian Anderson's actually Jethro Tull.
Yeah.
They go like, Jethro Tull, yeah, oh, he's going to come and play.
Yeah, that's why often you'll find their work filed under T instead of J.
Jethro.
Yeah, but it's not an unreasonable mistake to make.
Well, now what about, did you ever like Pink Floyd?
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. In all their iterations, you know. And recently I rediscovered the last album they put out, which was called The Endless River, which was a tribute to Richard Wright, who had passed on some years prior.
He was their keyboard player,
that's right. And so these are all outtakes from the last official Pink Floyd album, which was in 1994. I think that's called The Division Bell. These are all outtakes that Dave Gilmour and Nick Mason worked with as a homage to Richard Wright, because his keyboards are all over them. And I'm thinking, oh, this is a bit, you know, it's a bit samey, that sounds like that, that sounds like this. But that's the ultimate driving album I've discovered.
Really?
The Endless River, yeah. Otherwise, I particularly enjoyed their Syd Barrett phase and the phase before Dark Side of the Moon, before they became massive.
See Emily play.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
That was like the 3-minute songs, kind of like from the British invasion.
Yeah, although skewed by Syd Barrett's extraordinary LSD vision.
Yes.
You know, I mean, his lyrics are just, some of them are just bonkers, frankly.
Well, who wrote King Crimson's lyrics?
Various. Pete Sinfield.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Was
he wrote
the main
almost
lyricist.
ELP's early lyrics, too.
Originally, yeah.
I like this stuff.
Yeah.
It reminded me of William Blake in a way.
Yeah, no, he's a very interesting writer. Yeah, absolutely.
This is so cool talking with you about all this stuff.
Thanks. Yeah.
Well, James, let's just take about another minute and wrap this up, because that'll still give us about 15 or 18 minutes so the listeners can hear some of your music.
Yeah, that's great.
And so you're now involved in doing recording and backing for two women artists. And what were their names again?
Jackie Walters and Dana Sanarivi. She's they're both Nelson-based, quite different styles, but Jackie specializes more in slightly more English style folk with a bit of a twist, and Dana's work is a wee bit, she's half Samoan, so her work's got a wee bit more of a Pacific vibe to it, a wee bit poppier.
Yes.
So but I'm bringing a similar thing to both ladies in terms of colouring in the music, nice textures and, you know, just nice harmonic input.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I really want to thank you for taking the time to do this, and maybe we can do another show too. But I love your music, and
thanks, Jeff. Yeah.
I want to thank you for also doing making the sort of whale type sounds with your fretless bass and the e-bow, with Kate on violin. That was really, really cool.
Nice. Thank you.
Thanks, my brother.
All right. Jolly good.
Thank you.